This is Independent Librarian. I've just come home from a place in Langley where I talked to a Nazi war criminal. I don't know how do you deal with something like this? I have no idea where to even start with this. I got to get this all down now before it fades from my mind, and I've got to make sure that this gets out to Sim. I'm going to drop this off tonight before anything else. The minute I'm done this recording, I'm going to forward it to him. We're going to try to get it on the air. I don't care. This goes beyond the after now. This goes beyond anything that I've been involved with, for sure. Started 3 or 4 days ago. I guess it would have been a Thursday night. I had a kid come up to me at Colossus. I don't want to go into too many details about him. Actually, I shouldn't go into too many details. I should probably specify a few details about you. This is probably most definitely going to be the most illegal broadcast I have ever made in my life. If nothing I've said before has had people after me, trust me, this will have them after me. This will have them come after me with everything they got. I'm sure of it. If you hear this, if you can record this, if you can stream rip this, if you can download this from a website, replicate it, give it away, make audio recordings of it, make CD recordings of it, try to broadcast it, get this message out to people so that they can learn the truth. This, like I was saying, this kid came up to me when I was working in the theater in Langley. I was outside, and I recognized him. You know, you can always tell. Well, I can always tell listeners of the show and stuff. Like, they're always, you know, they stand out in a crowd. He came up to me and said, "Hey, are you Sean Kennedy?" And I made him for a log right away. I said, yeah, I'm Sean. How you doing? He said, "Listen, man, I need your help." And I thought he was going to ask me for wares. You know, I thought he was like, "Hey, I need an OS," because I get that all the time. I get, like, hacks and everything. And he said, "Listen, man, I need your help with my grandfather." And I said, "Your grandfather?" He said, "Yeah, he needs a reporter, and I don't know any reporters, and we tried to get reporters to talk to him 2 years ago, and they didn't listen. And I think he's dying now, and I need to get somebody to listen to him." So we talked for a bit, and I don't want to get too specific with the kid, because I don't want him labeled with this. This is the kind of stuff that can haunt someone for the rest of their life. But he was from an area of Langley called Eastleigh Crescent. It's really low income. And when he told me that's where he was living with his grandfather and his mother in this little rundown shack, I said, "Yeah, sure, okay, you know, we'll check it out. Let's go down there. You know, there's lots of low income housing, apartments shared, you know, really, really scummy area. Like, if lots of crack and lots of meth heads." So I said, "Sure, yeah, okay. When do you want to do this? Well, why don't you come over on Sunday, and you can talk to him." And he gave me his address, and I said, "Fine." And I didn't actually think much about it. I thought, well, you know, it might be cool. So the week went on, and I made plans and was recording after now and making sure everything was moving along when Sunday rolled around, and everything's changed. Now, to really appreciate this, I got to describe to you what Eastleigh Crescent is like. It's housing, condos, joined together, built back in the 70s when boxy was good. Everything is a dirty rock finish on the outside, chunks of glass ground into it. The kind of facing that if you were to run your hand along it, you'd probably bring back a bloodied stump. There's broken bottles and needles all over the street there. The streets, if you can call them that, are more like broken chunks of concrete in between potholes. And there's always a stray dog or a cat running around. When I showed up on Sunday, it was just looking like it was going to start to rain, so I parked my little Honda and got out, knocked on the door. The mom answered the door, and she was a smoker. You know, total white trash kind of mom thing going on there. I don't like to make judgment calls, but I mean, she was rough. I mean, I don't know if she was a user or what, but she was in bad shape, and the kid was there too. First thing I want to do is make sure that the kid didn't feel embarrassed about his situation there, you know? I mean, he obviously thought something of me, and I just took it all in stride. anyway, the mom didn't say too much. She just opened the door and disgustingly made a reference towards it, her child, and was like, yeah, he's here, you know, and that was it. She went back into the living room, so I didn't follow. He came up, got me, and brought me into the house and upstairs to the bedroom where his grandfather was. Now, the first thing that hits you about a room like that is the smell. It had that stale urine smell. Like if a cat pissed on a bunch of old books and then you locked them in a trunk for 6 months, yeah, that's kind of what the room smelled like. It was just lingering enough to make you want to gag. But I was lucky, I managed to keep it down. Very little light coming into the room, and I was glad I didn't bring Sim to film the whole thing because, I mean, I could barely make anything out. But laying there in the bed was this old guy. And after a certain age, you can't really tell how old people are anymore, you know, past like 80 or 85. I mean, they just get more wrinkled. They're almost genderless. They're just old. And he was laying there in the bed. And as my eyes adjusted to the room, I was amazed with how minimal everything was in there. There wasn't a lot of clutter. A lot of old folks' rooms, you know, you got memories and memorabilia from their lives scattered everywhere. You've got pictures on the wall, you got loved ones, you know, war medals, the rest of it. But this guy had nothing. His bedroom looked like a hotel room. He even smoothed out the blankets that were within reach of his hands. You could see where his hands would just be brushing them down, trying to keep it orderly or maybe wipe something away. I didn't know what it was. And the kid, he walked up to the old guy and gently patted his hand and said, "Grandpa, Grandpa, he's here." And the old man opened his eyes. And at that point, I thought maybe he was unconscious, or maybe he was sleeping, or he passed out or something, but it was so easy how he opened his eyes. I thought maybe he just was lying there faking the whole thing. And he looked at me. He looked at me the way something with higher knowledge. But I got looked at one time in a zoo by an elephant. I'll never forget that. I was in Toronto and this elephant looked at me, which sounds weird, you know, just an animal looks at you. But when you have an animal that massive that's lived that long, has seen as many things, and it looks at you, it's not looking at you, it's looking into you, it's looking through you, it's trying to find something inside of you that's real. And I'm really certain that within those first few seconds of him laying eyes on me, he made a decision whether or not he was going to talk to me, and I guess it was a favorable one. Because let me tell you the story he told me.
So, you are this reporter. Come now to hear what I have to say.
And I said, yeah. Well, I'm not really a reporter. Well, I guess I kind of am, you know. I'm a librarian. I put knowledge into the internet and give it away for free. I distribute information to young people and who's ever listening.
My name is Gunther Nussbaum, and I am a war criminal.
Now, there's something to be said when a man that old uses the word war criminal. And without any other indication, I knew that every word he was going to say to me was going to be what he believed to be the truth. I wasn't there as a reporter. I was there as a priest. Semi-digital confessional, electronic messiah to try to absolve this guy of sins that he was going to carry with him wherever the hell he was going. He motioned for the boy to leave. And the kid just got up and left. I mean, I don't know if the kid knows what the old man said. I suspect he did, because, I mean, when the old guy claimed he was a war criminal, the kid didn't even bat an eye, which if one of my grandparents told me they were a war criminal, I think I'd be pretty interested in what they had to say if I didn't know. So he waited for the boy to close the door, and then he went on.
During the early years of the war, I was a biochemist for the Fatherland. At that time, we all worked for the greater good. The Führer was leading us onwards. It was a time that you cannot understand now. But what we were doing was always right. Stalingrad was the beginning of the end for us, I think. And it was at that time that I knew the human sciences would not be enough. We had to go into the realms. We had to go into the places where no one knew. We had to consult texts which never existed. We had to look at the research of fringe scientists, Blavatsky and such. In 1943, a colleague, Dr. Hans Verrucht, was doing extreme research with texts acquired from India. He was a member of a society that was within the SS, within the Nazi party. He said that they could use a man of my talents and make sure that if the end should come, the Reich could live on within the minds of us, so that we could build the Reich again and it would never fall.
He was silent for a long time after he said that. I think that was a turning point. At that point, he could have, you know, sent me out of the room and claimed the whole thing was a gag. He could have said that, you know, he was just an old man and senile, but, no, I was there. And he had a story to tell me. And it was time to absolve him of the sins that he had.
I never would have joined, had it not been for Verrucht. The research that the Order of Sewell was able to acquire was beyond the realms of man, beyond reason. It went beyond conventional knowledge. I was a single man. I dedicated myself solely to the work and to the Fatherland. Once I joined the Order of Sewell in 1943, I became dead. My death was announced in papers and journals. Dead to the living world, I became hidden within the secrets of the Gestapo elite. Inside Sewell, we followed the man who the Führer followed. The man who ruled Sewell. A man we knew only as Bernard, but I know his name. I know his true name. I am old now. My body is dying. Failure is coming to each of my organs in the most painful way. But my mind is still strong. You must tell others of this.
And I said, yeah, you bet. Don't worry, man. I'm going to tell as many people as I can about this. You just keep on talking.
Once I joined the Order, they put me to work in Tiergartenstrasse 4 in Berlin. I worked very closely with a man named Kurt Blum. an expert in plagues, viruses, things with nature bio attacks. And it was there, with the additional help of Varuk and a few others from camps, we developed the first Persephone compound. This compound is a chemical treatment. It derived from hormone glands of subjects. It cannot be synthetically produced. It must be, even today, produced with living glands. It is a raw mixture with tetrodotoxins, powerful toxics. It was an aggression drug, something we could feed to captured prisoners, make them work for us. We had no idea what the effects would be. The first field trials were tried in the Ukraine. We took 3 prisoners, brought them to a city, outskirts of town, and we injected them with a serum. The compound worked very quickly. The rage fills them. But immediately, we noticed the advanced, rapid putrefaction of the living flesh. The side effects of the compound were like watching men rot away in front of you, but mostly surface tissues, first dermal layers, skin, hair, thin layers of flesh, the ears, eyelids, some gradual rot of the lips. Symptoms vary depending on size, weight, height. But the smell of death filled them. They were walking dead. And the desire, the conscious mind is destroyed. All that is left is raw aggression. They attacked each other and then ran to the town. 2 of them were killed by farmers. They were chopped up with axes. The 3rd, we were able to recapture and bring back for studies. In today's times, you would have called them a chemical creation. They exhibited all of the physical symptoms of one that is a reanimated corpse, yet the act of dying never occurred. It was as though the brain stopped, the body began to rot, and all that was left was the savagery. It was the end of the war. Things became complicated. The Nazi Party fell, but the Order of Soul looked after his own as the pledges. Our treasurer, a man named Prescott Bush, made certain that Bloom and I were brought in on an American project known as Paperclip. Bloom was captured, but even still was managed to avoid the persecution at Nuremberg and was brought with me across the ocean to work for the American government. You over here are so proud of your government, yet the atrocities that they committed and still commit makes the research you did look like child's play. Then we joined the projects. My identity had changed so many times, I don't even remember what names I had. They seized all of our research, of course, after the war. But the Persephone compound was valuable to them. They liked the idea of mindless control soldiers or indigenous populace able to be controlled through medication on a massive scale. But unlike our research, they were doing cross-experimentation with electromagnetic frequencies, a field I'm totally unfamiliar with. My area of expertise was brain chemistry, reaction of hormones. There were so many projects we worked on with derivatives from our research with Persephone. There's the MK-Often, MK-Search, MK-Delta. Throughout all of the 50s and 60s, we worked various compounds. And at that time, there's so much research, 20 years. The results were slow but positive. Throughout all of this, I renamed Loyal to Sul. Contact was maintained. We were able to meet at prestigious universities under the cloak of darkness and under the guise of research. My contract was fulfilled with the American government as of 1980, and to the day I left. As promised, they have given me a foolproof identity, and I was able to try to live a life of peace. But there is no peace here. The sins. So many sins. If the Führer had completed the vision, the world would be a much better place now, but instead you have government making pacts with lesser races. You have their research falling into the wrong hands. They know nothing of secrets. Even the most elite forces are common knowledge put upon t-shirts for children, glorifying your great killers. They have put up a barrier. It was almost completed when I left. Controlled by a huge antenna array in the north called HARP. And these antennas communicate with relay stations and repeaters strategically placed throughout North America. They are a barrier to keep the populace from asking too many questions. It's a final defense against rebellion.
But why did they do this? Why would the government do that?
Don't be stupid. Every empire falls, and it invariably falls to its own people. We knew this. Thule knew this. This is not a German organization. This is not a Bavarian organizations, global, far larger than anything you can possibly grasp. They will kill you for this. You are dead now, as you sit listening to me. But you will do your part to spread this. And if you can tell only a few people, then you have fulfilled your function here.
To be looked at so objectively, so
clinically by this Nazi piece of shit really made me want to stab him in the neck. But I mean, this is an old man lying in a bed. I don't even know if the guy's serious. I don't know if he's senile or what. I mean, he's obviously racist. But why would he call me down here? Why would he lie to me? I didn't know what to say, so I just finally I said, "Why are you telling me this now? Why now? I mean, it's past 2000, man. You're dying. What possible good can this serve?"
My grandson is naive. He knows very little of my involvement in the war. He thinks I was Fallschirmjäger. This is not the case. But the children of the Western world are the victims. They are the ones that will be infected.
And when he said infected, my blood ran cold. I asked him, "What do you mean, infected? What are you talking about here?"
The frequency fences in place, you fool. The compounds, the parts of Persephone compound have been placed into your food processing industry. They are hidden in exorphins to hide their true nature.
You can't expect me to believe that the government is feeding the general populace chemicals that are going to cause them to rot. I mean, that doesn't make sense. I mean, why would they? It would be exposed. There'd be more evidence of this.
No. It's not all of the compound. There is a critical component they hold back. And this component is what they call the Black Wind. In a time of crisis, they will release it. And the symptoms will start to show. Fear of the plague will keep people in their homes. It is fear that they will rule, just as we ruled before.
What do you mean the plague? They can't be feeding these guys the same stuff that you fed to those dudes in the Ukraine.
No, not the same. Purified. Clinically mastered. The dosage is so much stronger now. The amount that they used to create the test subjects could infect an entire city now. You will know it when it begins to show in the news. My words will ring true to you. Your enemies have knowledge of this compound. They will use your insecurity as your weakness. It will start slow. You will see them in the farmlands where the testing will begin. They will claim that people have gone mad. They'll turn on each other. Will smash their heads open with hammers and any heavy implements they can lift.
Why? Why would they do that? Why would they start ripping people's heads off? That doesn't make sense. So you get infected with this plague and you start ripping off people's heads?
It's not the heads they want. It is the hormones. Persephone creates a drive. A adrenal life force that seeks to maintain itself. your senses become keener. And you hunt through smelling of pheromones to a source of the hormones you would find and need. They can only be taken from living human tissue. Your government will deny this, of course. They will call them isolated incidents. None of the bodies will be examined by the press. Any photographs or video footage will be destroyed. It is only through the network that you have that perhaps this knowledge may be distributed.
I watched him breathe. My mind was screaming. How do you respond to something like that? Something boiled to the surface, and I asked him, I said, what do we do?
You must consume only food that you know is clean. Pure food that you know source. And there is perhaps one other thing you can do to stop this madness.
And I said, what? I mean, we can do whatever it takes. I mean, if this is what's going to happen to the people of North America, I mean, we'll do whatever it takes.
Don't be so sure of yourself, librarian. You could kill Bernard. He still lives. So the research that Rook and others like him did. I don't know how, but I have seen him, and he lives still in a young, strong body. A luxury I no longer have.
How do we find this Bernard? How do we... I mean... Where do you start looking?
His name is Dietrich Eckhart. He still lives. He is still the leader of Seoul.
And with that, he seemed to drip back into sleep. And the sound of the machines just kept on going. I didn't know what else to do, so I stood up and got ready to leave. I think that was pretty much it. I had more than enough to chew on. As I turned to leave the room, I heard his voice again behind me. His tone was different. Sadder, somehow.
I remember that it was Joseph used to say. The more we do to you, the less you believe we are doing it.
Marcelo.